This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a GHIL lecture by Regina Töpfer, Chair of German Philology at the University of Würzburg, on Homer's Heroes in Early Modern Germany, a Translational Anthropology. Regina Töpfer presents her concept of translational anthropology and shows how philological comparisons can reveal patterns of thought, systems of knowledge, and values held by historical individuals and societies. She considers literary translations to be key anthropological texts and sees shifts in meaning between the source and target text not as aesthetic shortcomings, but as cultural gains. This model is presented through an analysis of the first translation of Homer into German in 1537-38. Simon Scheidenreisser's Odyssee offers numerous insights into social norms, ideals, and difficult issues in the early modern period.
Thank you very much for your introduction. It's a great pleasure and honor for me to be here. Thank you very much for your coming. I have published a book in English, but I'm not the one who wrote this book in English. I cooperate with a wonderful translator, and my science language is German. And so I hope that you will understand everything what I want to introduce to you, and I'll do my best. And I also had a wonderful translator here for my paper in this evening, and I want to thank him very much too. Homer's Heroes in Early Modern Germany, a Translational Anthropology. I start my lecture with chapter one, The Cultural Turn in German Studies. I will begin this lecture by reflecting on my own disciplinary perspective. As a specialist in medieval German philology, who is researching the translation cultures in the early modern period. The cultural turn took hold in the humanities in the late 90s. There was extensive discussion among literary scholars and philologists about whether and to what extent they should use the insights of cultural studies. This is shown by the numerous essays and volumes published around the turn of the millennium that presented literary studies as a form of cultural studies. Some argued in favor of opening up their discipline and develop new perspectives, while others worried that German studies might lose its profile and its specific research focus. Not only the discipline self-understanding, but also the very justification for its existence seemed to be at stake. Why should German studies be preserved as a distinct subject and remain anchored in the university curriculum if no longer transmitted any aesthetic competencies and if it worked with the same sources as neighboring disciplines? For literary historians who focus on the period from the 17th century to the present day, such questions were far more urgent than they were for those who focus on the Middle Ages. From the earliest days of the discipline, medievalists had adopted a broad understanding of literature and examined all texts written in German, not only those that met lofty poetic standards. As such, they saw the cultural challenge to philology not so much as a threat and more as an affirmation of their work. For their modern counterparts, by contrast, the call for a cultural turn cut against the tradition of their discipline, which had upheld aesthetic ideals ever since Goethe's day. It thus posed a threat to the long-standing philological convention of strictly separating aesthetics from historical and life experience. Nonetheless, many scholars voted to expand their methods and the object of their research. Texts would no longer be considered as autonomous systems, but as components of a larger cultural context. Against this backdrop, my proposal to proclaim a cultural turn in German studies might seem behind the times, were it not for the fact that I am referring to a type of text that has been largely excluded from this development, namely translations. Studies of translated literature are nowhere to be found in any of the volumes published so far on German studies as a cultural science. Chapter 2, the special status of literary translations. One likely reason why translations have been neglected in cultural studies is that scholars tacitly apply modern ideas of linguistic equivalence to them. Although works of world literature are largely consumed in translation by interested students, researchers, and others, literary scholars rarely acknowledge that translated works are produced by intermediaries who interpret source texts according to their own understanding. The current understanding of translation in literary studies is oddly limited. Also, there were certain signs that should make us pay closer attention to it. Different translation methods have been debated since antiquity. There is no consistent definition of the word, and there is no even a standalone discipline devoted to translation studies. Despite this development, however, translations are often granted no independent textual status of their own, and instead are frequently read as direct and unmediated statements by the original author. A further obstacle to the inclusion of translated literature in post-cultural turn German studies is that literary and aesthetic maxims of Goethe's days remain highly influential. Translations do not meet the requirement of originality that scholars and critics place on literary works. Translators work from a pre-existing source text and therefore apparently do not live up to the ideal of creative genius. The work is assumed to be only derivate, not inventive or innovative. To this day, when literary scholars analyze translations, they primarily discuss their poetic and aesthetic qualities, judging them by how well and accurately they reproduce the source text in the target language. Translators are thus marginalized from the outset. At best, they can approach the stylistic level of the source text, but they can hardly equal it. They are sometimes praised for capturing the tone of the original, but for the most part, they are accused of various deviations and lapses. Judgments of this kind generally have a moralizing force. Translators are charged with betraying the original and deceiving readers about the true state of affairs, whether inadvertently or deliberately. As long as translations are not seen as texts in their own right with hermeneutic, aesthetic, epistemic, and historical characteristics, their potential for cultural studies will go untapped. Chapter 3, Perspectives from Translation Studies. Theoretical and conceptual studies of the cultural significance of translations have not been provided by linguistics, literary studies, or cultural German studies, but by the new, constantly growing and largely anglophone discipline of translation studies. German translatology has also seen a cultural turn, which led it from linguistically oriented models of translation to an understanding based in cultural studies. Exponents of translation studies have long since distanced themselves from the idea that translation is a code-switching operation for which the content of the source text can be transferred unchanged into another language. Pragmatic understandings define translation an act in which various actors are involved and which refers to a specific context. While from a hermeneutic perspective, translation is dependent on individual, epistemic, linguistic, and biographical preconditions. People can only translate what they have understood. Worthwhile approaches to research into historical translations are found in descriptive translation studies, or DTS. Based on goal-oriented, functional, and systemic arguments, this discipline focused on studying literary translation with their cultural contexts and as products of a specific translational process. In DTS, translations are treated as cultural facts and as historic objects belonging to a target culture, since they were initiated by that culture and do not overlap with a source text. One of the basic assumptions in DTS is that the act of translation is shaped by political, social, and linguistic norms. Translators have to conform to the values and ideals of the target culture in order to avoid being sanctioned. Surprisingly, philologists studying translation have addressed in only rudimentary fashion the translational turn that has taken place in cultural studies since the 80s and have failed to develop it. The opportunity to historicize translation studies went unused, and so did the possibility of bringing techniques of literary scholarship and linguistic analysis more strongly into the theoretical debate over cultural translation. Instead of literary scholars, it was historians and social scientists who elevated translation into a guiding concept, ignoring poetic and aesthetic texts in the process. Above all, they asked how cultures come into contact and how morals, customs, rituals and means are transferred from one cultural setting to another. This draws attention to so-called cultural brokers, actors who cross the boundaries between different languages, regions, religions and ethnicities, and drive new cultural developments through borrowing. Generally speaking, such concepts of cultural translation have little in common with philological analyses of translations in which comparisons are made on the word, sentence, and chapter level. Bruno Latour goes so far as to explicitly rule out the linguistic and literary dimension in his inquiry into technical translation, which he believes to be characterized by displacement, drift, mediation, and invention. Latour sees translation as the creation of a link that did not previously exist, one that modifies the two original elements or agents to a certain extent. In light of such broad definitions, linguistic and literary scholars often have the impression that historians and social scientists only use the concept of translation in a metaphorical sense, and thus run the risk of applying it arbitrarily. As a result, interlingual and cultural understandings of translation have long stood apart. Only recently have attempts been made to combine the different theoretical approaches and to establish an incremental concept of translation that can be fruitfully used by literary scholars, historians, and social scientists. This is the central approach of the German Research Foundation Priority Program 2130, early modern translation cultures, of which I'm the spokesperson and director. Chapter 4, the early modern period as an era of translation. The early modern period is especially interesting for historical research on translation for two reasons. First, it was a time of cultural dynamism, of heterogeneity and non-simultaneity, of authority and pluralism. And second, the cultural practice of translation plays such a central role in the early modern era that it even constitutes this period, especially regarding its cultural and literary history. From the mid-15th century, the number of translations grew rapidly, and many works, especially the classics, but increasingly texts from other literatures and fields of knowledge too, were translated into the vernacular for the first time. The printing press encouraged and accelerated this development, including through new forms of intermediality. Translation methods were discussed in numerous paratexts. Many early modern authors declared that they did not translate word for word, but matched sense for sense. Of course, this popular distinction hardly does justice to the diversity and complexity of translation. It is not a defined method, but a topos from the classical rhetoric that was used by translators to position themselves in the scholarly discourse. Statements such as these, which suggest a new awareness of translation issues, are reflective of a shift from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. Medievalists in German studies have assigned near-canonical importance to the distinction between retelling and translation. For instance, Franz Josef Wolfsbrock contrasts the free recycling of content from romances during the Middle Ages with a greater fidelity to the original, including in terms of form that he believes to be typical of humanism. However, binary models like these put researchers in the awkward position of having determined what is a translation and what is not. Time and again, early modernists have debated whether particular texts are genuine translations. Instead of adopting the more open concept of cultural translation used by historians and social scientists, literary scholars have deployed competing descriptors such as adaptation and transfer in a bid to define their linguistic and literary observations in conceptual terms and to highlight failures of equivalence. Yet the specificity and the appeal of early modern translations occupy an intractable middle ground between similarity and difference that can only be defined on a case-by-case basis. The vernacular translations of the early modern period adhere more closely to their source texts than medieval German Antikenromane, romances based on classical narratives. However, they also diverge from modern expectations of what translation should do, as they include numerous glosses, paraphrases, and adaptations to the target culture. Some early modern translators emulate their much-admired classical predecessors and sought to match or even to surpass them. This dual motivation of imitatio and emulatio brings their own creativity particularly clearly into view. Other translators aimed not to replace the source text, but to develop and expand on it. They connected their translated text with further knowledge, embedded them in commentaries, and present them as encyclopedic textbooks. Early New High German translators have at times been heavily criticized for their consistent focus on the target audience. Yet it is precisely these shifts in emphasis that make early modern translation literature so interesting to scholars of philology and cultural studies. Next chapter, historical anthropology and translation research. My own proposal to carry out philological translation research as a part of cultural studies is based on the concept of translational anthropology. It is underpinned by the hypothesis that translations are key anthropological texts in that they are written by humans for humans and deal with human affairs. I'm not talking here about anthropology in a philosophical sense, which looks at the general and universal characteristics of humans across all periods. Translation can certainly be described as a genuinely human activity that spans eras and cultures, one that can be traced from the beginnings of recorded history in ancient Egypt, via Greek, Jewish, and Arabic written cultures, right up to the present day. Yet translational anthropology is not concerned with either the general human demand for translations or the aspects of human nature that they reveal. Instead, its goal is to study translations in order to identify the human qualities that are characteristic of a particular period, a specific context, a unique cultural situation, and a historically socialized individual. Like historical anthropology, translational anthropology thus places the specific human being at the center of the historical analysis, along with his or her actions, thoughts, feelings, and afflictions. Many works of cultural and literary anthropology use the methodology of thick description, developed by the ethnologist Clifford Geertz. The goal is not to achieve complete fusion of horizons with the object of their research, which Friedrich Schleiermacher stated to be the goal of any hermeneutic process. Instead, anthropologically minded literary scholars seek to adopt a fresh ethnological perspective on all too familiar canonical texts, treating them in a sense as unknown phenomena. And while anthropological lawyers of meaning are found in literary works in general, they are particularly present in translations. Literature and literary translations are capable of expressing aspects of reality and experience that can only be articulated in poetic forms. Until now, historical anthropologists have dismissed translations as uninteresting or banal. This may be because researchers have been operating with an essentialist understanding of translation, believing that the substance of a translated text does not differ from the source and therefore offers little insight. A prime example of this can be seen in a lengthy German handbook of historical anthropology titled For Menschen, on Humankind, which attempts to include every possible aspect of the subject. It covers a wide range of topics, including cosmology, world and objects, genealogy and gender, the body, media and education, and fate and coincidence. It contains entries on language, writing, school, religion, music, theater, ritual, play, meat, knowledge, and much more besides. But not translation. And yet, translations are first-rate sources for literary anthropological questions, since they promise richer analytical findings than primary texts. There are two reasons for this. First, dealing with the unknown foreign source text poses a particular challenge for the translator who links and harmonizes certain aspects of the source culture with the target culture, but also sometimes problematizes and eliminates them. The exact way in which the translator offers deep insights for cultural researchers. Second, analyzing translations in this way helps to broaden research pictures, horizons, by providing a historical counterpart to their own situationally bound perspective, and thus partly relativizing it. Translations allow the ideals, norms, and guiding concepts of the target culture to be identified for comparison with an independent benchmark. The source text offers a backdrop against which social, cultural, and historical anthropological particularities come clearly into view. The shifts in emphasis from the source to the target text indicate the ideas about the world, God, humanity, gender, sexuality, health, youth, old age, life, and death that shape a particular society. This forms the basis for a Foucauldian archaeology of anthropological knowledge. The philological analysis of translations allows deeper insights to be gained into the social practices, historical discourses, and ethical norms of the early modern and other eras. In a sense, then, translational anthropology inverts the traditional view of translations. Since classical antiquity, authors have lamented the difficulty involved in producing adequate translations and the paucity of their respective target languages. The early modern era, likewise, offers many examples of translators who complained about the limited expressiveness of the German language and its barbarism compared to the elegance of Latin. Yet, translational anthropology no longer judges linguistic and hermeneutic deviations to be aesthetic shortcomings or losses, and instead sees them as gains from a cultural studies perspective. The focus is not on interlingual equivalence, whether at the level of the word or the sentence, but on cultural historical shifts that can, of course, only be established through philological comparison at the micro level of the text. Translations that differ noticeably from their source texts are especially interesting to historians of translation and translational anthropologists alike. As such, it makes sense to extend the analysis to intermediary translations, of which there are numerous examples in the early modern period. Second-hand translations are not the exception but the rule here, especially when it comes to works of Greek antiquity. Unlike previous research on the early modern period, translational anthropology is not solely focused on the reconstructing the historic social or media context in which a given translation was produced. Instead, it seeks to determine the patterns of thought and repositories of knowledge in a given historical society based on linguistic and literary interpretations. As such, the connection with the target culture is more important than any hermeneutic aspects, albeit without denying that individual understanding is always crucially important in translation. Compared to historians, literary scholars are in a privileged position because they can register literary dimensions of meaning using their own philological methods. In this way, it is possible to study how ideas about human activity and about people's relationship with the divine, the natural world, and the community are expressed in language and literature. As they consider how to adapt existing templates, narrative forms, and rhetorical traditions, translators find answers to the fundamental questions of human existence that differ from those provided from the source texts. These shifts in meaning are the central focus of my research project on translational anthropology, in which I am working with two colleagues to study 16th century translations of the classics. This is one of the 13 sub-projects that form part of the second funding phase of the DFG priority program, Early Modern Translation Cultures. Chapter 6, analyzing the opening of the Odyssey through the lens of translational anthropology. I would now like to demonstrate the analytical model of translational anthropology by turning to the opening scene of the first German translation of the Odyssey. This was authored by Simon Scheidenreisser, known as Minervius, and published by Alexander Weißenhorn in Augsburg in late 1537 or 1538. Homer's epics were among the works rediscovered by humanist scholars. Homer had been known only by name during the Middle Ages, and his works were made accessible to the Latin West for the first time in the early modern period when they were translated into vernacular language through the intermediary language of Latin. The significance of the cultural practice of translation in the early modern period is shown by the self-reflexive comments that Scheidenreisser added to his version of the Odyssey. His foreword explicitly engaged with the goals and motives of his translation. In his own words, he translated the Odyssey not just in order to make the father of all poetry known in the vernacular and to present his heroes as moral paradigms for the virtuous life. Rather, he also sought to enrich both German literature and German as a literary language. His many paratexts were also intended to offer his German-speaking readers deeper insights into Homer's ancient culture and to help them better understand what went on in his world. With his prefaces and interlinear and marginal clauses, Scheidenreisser applies the scholarly annotation methods used in school books, which he would have been very familiar with as the former rector of the Latin school in Munich. This typically medieval mode of text production could be described using a term borrowed from modern translation studies as thick translation. Its aim is to communicate the target text as effectively as possible by providing additional information, and as a result, the text is embedded in commentaries. In the following analysis, I will compare Scheidenreisser's translation with its Latin source text, a translation produced by the Italian humanist scholar Raphael Volaterranos, and the Greek original, which I will paraphrase based in part on Richmond Latimore's modern English translation. Antramoi enepemusa polytropon, os malapolla, planchte epetro jes hieron tolietron eperse. Gottin des Gesangs, dich ruf ich an, hilf preisen mir den teuren Mann, der Land und Städt durchreiset hat, geübt dazu man fährlich tat. From the very beginning, it is clear that the narrator of the German translation sympathizes with and admires Odysseus. He wishes to prize the dear man, teuren Mann. The Latin source text lacks this expression of esteem. Instead, Volaterranos speaks merely of a man, virum. In this way, he avoids the hermeneutic challenge of having to decide on a clear interpretation of the Greek adjective polytropos. Even today, translators struggle with how to describe Odysseus on his first appearance. In German worksheets, he is presented as vielgewandt, much skilled, Wolfgang Schadewald, or wandelbar, changeable, Kurt Steinmann. In English, he is characterized as a man already at need, Samuel Butler, or for shrewdness, fame, William Cowper, or even in the 2070 translation by Emily Wilson as a complicated man. By contrast, our first impression of Odysseus in the early New High German translation of the Odyssey is entirely positive. This is partly because Scheidenreisser omits the central narrative element of the sack of Troy. Unlike in the Greek original and the Latin translation, Odysseus is not introduced as a destroyer of cities. Instead, he is introduced as a courageous, responsible, and level-headed hero. Unlike in the source text, the German Odysseus is not a man who has suffered greatly through various shipwrecks. in Latin, multa quoque et ponto passus dum naufragus erat, but one who has done many valiant deeds, geübt dazu manch gefährlich Tat. Odysseus is clearly raised above his companions, emphasizing the hierarchical difference between the leader and his followers. In Volaterrano's version, he strives to save both his own life and those of his comrades. Ut sibi tum socius vitam sapiret. In Scheibenreißers, by contrast, Odysseus fears not for himself, but only for his men, whom he wishes he would have saved from danger. Like in the source text, his failure to do so is explained through the unreasonable behavior of his companions. In the German version, Odysseus' men are more strongly disparaged and called foolish, weislos, meaning without reason, before they are characterized as such by their actions. In both the Latin source text and the Greek original, they are only called fools after the narrator described how they stole and devoured the oxen of Helios. The German version presents this lapsus as far more problematic because it omits the men's main motive, namely their hunger, fame. In fact, Scheibenreißer's narrator claims that they stole the sun god's cattle willfully, mutwilliglich. Similarly, the consequences of this action are far more dramatic in the vernacular than in Latin or Greek. Odysseus' men are not merely banned from returning home, they perish and rot in rain, snow, and wind. Odysseus, by contrast, is characterized as the epitome of wisdom. This is something that Scheibenreißer repeatedly draws attention to in both his paratexts and in the vocabulary he uses in his translation. At the beginning of Homer's narrative, Odysseus finds himself in a singular position. All the other Greeks who survived the war and the sea are already back at home. Only Odysseus has been prevented from returning home, and this is blamed on the nymph Calypso. Once again, comparing the different language versions reveals interesting variations, in this case concerning the hero's relationship with female figures. Volaterranos follows Homer in describing Calypso as a divine nymph who wants Odysseus to be her husband. Nympha dia Calypsa virum habere cupiens. By contrast, Scheibenreißer enhances the attractiveness of his hero by saying that a goddess, and not just a nymph, wants him as her marital consort, ehelichen Gemahl. By emphasizing marriage, Scheibenreißer follows the moral ideas of the early modern period and channels Calypso's desire down an appropriate path. He makes it clear that the goddess has serious intentions, but that these cannot be realized. After all, as the early modern High German reader would have gleaned from the preface, Odysseus is already married to the best of all women, Penelope. Gender relations in the first German translation of the Odyssey are thus largely in line with contemporary ideas. The protagonist is portrayed less as a lover and more as the head of a family and of a nation. While in Latin version, Odysseus longs to return home to his wife, ulissim reditum conjungemque carentem, the early New High German translation primarily stresses the unreasonable behavior of Calypso in keeping him far from his country and from his wife and children, von Weib und Kindern. This element of fatherhood, newly introduced by Scheibenreißer in his translation, is ripe for an interpretation from the perspective of translational anthropology. I have also addressed this topic in my study on infertility in medieval and early modern Europe. By mentioning the children who are waiting at home for their missing father, Scheibenreißer lends extra weight to Odysseus' ties to his wife and homeland. Adopting a critical perspective on normativity, It also seems that the thought of Odysseus' beloved wife is not enough on its own to justify his desire to return home. Women and children are given equal status, forming a syntactic, semantic, and emotional unit, representing Penelope as the mother of several children. Scheidenreiser also introduced an internal contradiction to his German translation, as Telemachus remains an only child elsewhere in the text. However, this underscoring of Odysseus and Penelope's parenthood corresponds to an ideal of the family that took hold in the early modern period and was propagated especially by Protestant preachers, namely that parenthood is the precondition for a successful marriage, or indeed, for a happy life in general. By introducing the motive of children, Scheidenreiser projects the social expectation that loving spouses should be happy parents back into the ancient world, thereby conforming the contemporary equitation of marriage, love, and fertility. On the other hand, the German version does not mention Odysseus' painful yearning for his home. This is in line with his presentation at the beginning of the text, where he's not a stoical sufferer, but a man of action who rescues other people. Yet the German translator, like his predecessors, stresses that Calypso's wishes are not shared by Odysseus. The goddess is keeping the hero against his will, wider seinen Willen. The idea of God. Odysseus' years of confinement only end when the gods deem that the time has come. Unlike Homer, Volaterranos does not talk in generalities about divine decrees, but specifically mentions the fates who weave the hero's homecoming. Scheidenreiser's translation dispenses with mythological references and claims that Odysseus is destined to return to his fatherland in accordance with the eternal providence, ewiger Versehung, and that further battles await him there. This prediction once again emphasizes Odysseus' strength. Time and again, the German translation of the Odyssey talks of challenges that the hero overcomes rather than the anguish and misfortune that befall him. By hegemonic notions of manliness in the early modern era leaves no room for a suffering hero. By speaking of the divine providence, Scheidenreiser makes it easy for contemporary readers to understand the ancient world of the gods from a Christian perspective. The implication that the eternal providence refers to the will of an almighty God is made clear in a marginal note which says, Homer speaks of the divine eternal providence, in Latin, predestination. This comment presents the hero of the classical epic as a proto-Christ. In the Odyssey, we see the gods fill the room and take their seats before the highest among them, Zeus, begins to speak. Homer and Volaterranos both call him the father of the gods and of men, Pater Deum ad quo hominum, while Scheidenreiser adds two names that reinforce Jupiter's higher rank and once again provide associations with Christian ideas, the highest god and an almighty father. Another difference pertaining to the religion is established through a shift in focus. In Homer's version, the narrator offers a glimpse of Zeus' inner life by noting what he thinks in his heart, thymos. Volaterranos similarly provides readers with an insight into Jupiter's thoughts before the god begins to speak. Scheidenreiser, by contrast, omits the repetition by going straight into Jupiter's speech. On the one hand, this is in keeping with his general tendency to shorten the text. On the other, it contributes to a consistent image of the divine. According to Judeo-Christian ideas, divine thoughts are inaccessible. See Isaiah 55. my last observation, love of the fatherland. Scheidenreiser makes Odysseus' love of his fatherland a recurring theme in his translation of the Odyssey. Yet he also assumes that this love is not so much an individual virtue as a broadly human, or more accurately, a broadly masculine passion. He speaks of Odysseus' drive towards and innate desire for his fatherland. By bringing together gender and emotion in this way, Scheidenreiser's idea of love for the fatherland is in certain respects reminiscent of maternal love, which has repeatedly been described in cultural history as an innate desire, a natural instinct among women. Homer contrasts Calypso's attempts at seduction with his hero's tormented longing for home. The infatuated nymph does all she can to ensure that Odysseus forgets Ithaca. Yet he yearns to see even just the smoke rising from his country and wants to die. Replacing the name Ithaca with the word fatherland, Scheidenreiser expands on his muse on of a patriotic hero. Calypso uses sweet, tender words in a bid to persuade Odysseus to forget his fatherland and remain with her. Odysseus' death wish, which is unacceptable to Christian morality, is reformulated by Scheidenreiser in order to avoid jeopardizing the idealized image of his protagonist. In his version, Minerva reports that Odysseus yearns only to see the smoke rising from his house. Then he would be ready to die. The longing for death in the Greek and Latin version thus becomes a readiness for death in the German, and the causal dependence is reduced to a purely temporal connection. Odysseus is prepared to make every effort in order to reach his fatherland just once more. The central importance of this motive is emphasized once again in a marginal note, stating that Odysseus' love for his fatherland is worth more to him than even immortality. Scheidenreiser takes this attitude as evidence for his notion that love for one's fatherland is innate, observing that nothing is sweeter than one's own fatherland. Nichts ist süßer dann das Vaterland. To conclude, this lecture has tried to show that philological translation analysis can be used to tease out anthropological detail and to draw wider conclusions about a given culture. The shifts in emphasis between source texts and translations testify to the norms and ideals of the target culture, but also reveal ruptures and problem areas. Of course, anthropological analysis is not the only way to study translations, but it can broaden the existing range of methodologies based on the history of mentalities, education, society, and the media, as well as those drawn from poetology and literary aesthetics. Comparing different translations, in particular, those up unique features that are typical of a given era and cultural environment. Early modern translations are particularly suitable objects for study from the perspective of translational anthropology, as the historical actors behind them inscribe their target texts with far more addenda, explanations, and paraphrases than do modern-day translators. Yet, my approach can also be applied to other works from different periods. Ultimately, translations are never invariant reproductions of a source text on which they are based, but always involve shifts and interpretations that are specific to the target culture. And this still applies today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.